Welcome to BrandonVaught.com, where today I'm talking with Father Dwight Longenecker. Father Dwight is a well-known Catholic writer, author, blogger, and a priest. He has a very interesting backstory on how he went from an evangelical fundamentalist background to becoming a Catholic priest, which we'll discuss in a little bit. Father Dwight is the best-selling author of numerous books, including The Gargoyle Code, which is a book written in the similar style to C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters, and also other books on topics like St. Therese of Lisieux, St. Benedict, Mary, and much more. His most recent book, which we'll also discuss here, is called Catholicism Pure and Simple. Father Dwight is probably best known for his blog, which can be found at patheos.com under the name Standing on Your Head. It is has been recently recognized as one of the top 100 most influential Christian blogs on the internet. And so, Father Dwight, we've worked together in the past, we've exchanged many emails, but I'm glad to be finally talking face-to-face. So thank you for doing this interview, and welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Brandon.
Now let's begin talking about your conversion story. One quote that I love and I've used in interviews past comes from G.K. Chesterton, and he said that the church is like a house with hundreds of gates, and no two people enter in at exactly the same angle. Your angle was incredibly unique. You went from evangelical fundamentalism to Anglicanism and finally to the Catholic priesthood. You've talked about your conversion story in length and on television shows like The Journey Home and in writings and periodicals. But can you give us the short, maybe 2-minute synopsis of how you made that journey?
Yes, thank you. Well, I was brought up as an evangelical in Pennsylvania. I went to Bob Jones University in South Carolina after graduating from high school. While I was there, I got a severe case of the disease called Anglophilia, which is the love of all things English. I've been reading C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien and T.S. Eliot, and I got the English bug. I traveled over there a couple of times. So when I was at Bob Jones, I actually became an Anglican and was baptized into the Anglican Church through a little breakaway Episcopal Church. And then, by God's wonderful providence, I had the wonderful fortune to go and study theology at Oxford. And you can imagine, for someone who likes C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, it was like a dream come true. So I went to study theology there for 3 years and then was ordained as an Anglican priest and served for 10 years in the Anglican Church in England, in the Church of England. While I was there, my understanding of the faith grew in a more and more Catholic direction. I realized that my journey to the Anglican Church was a search for the big old one, the church that was universal, the church which was ancient, the church went back to the apostles. And of course, coming from an evangelical background, it makes sense to take that step into Anglicanism looking for that. But the longer I lived in Europe and traveled over to France and Italy and so forth, the more I was drawn to the even bigger and older one, which is of course the Catholic Church. And it was in the early 1990s that the Church of England was discussing the issue of women's ordination, which made me look again at the question of authority in the Church. Up until then I was saying, like a lot of Anglicans do, I'm a Catholic but in the Anglican Church. Increasingly that was a difficult position to try to maintain. And in the debate over women's ordination, I, like hundreds of other of my fellow Anglican priests, looked again at the authority question. And without going on too long, just to say that both sides have had good arguments. Those who were for women's ordination, those who were against, they both had scriptural arguments, theological arguments, historical arguments. And I was trying to keep an open mind, and that's what really caused me to come back and say, well, how do you make such a decision? And then I came back and said, well, what does Rome say? What does the Catholic Church say? And the Catholic Church was able to look and consider this issue and look at it not just from the point of view of, what's good for England or North America or Europe, but of course brought the whole universal scope of the church to the question. What do the Asian Catholics think? What do the African Catholics think? What do the Catholics in Central and South America think? What does the church think on this issue for the last 2,000 years? It was that weight of authority, not just simply saying, oh, the Pope is infallible and that'll do for me, but it was this whole weight of where the authority comes from and the strength of that authority, the breadth of that authority, which of course was then articulated by the Holy Father. And so that brought me to the threshold of the Catholic Church, and I realized that I needed to come home to Rome, as so many others say.
Now, many of your Anglo-Catholic heroes, including men like C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton, wrestled with a lot of the so-called modern heresies of their day. You've written on your blog a lot about the so-called isms. These are things like relativism, materialism, sentimentalism, that are the favorite heresies of us moderns. In your mind, what are the most dangerous of these isms today?
Well, Brandon, that's actually one of the topics. I'm very often invited to go and do parish missions, and one of the evening talks is about the isms, and I actually pick out 12 different modern isms and show how they're actually countered by the church being one holy, Catholic, and apostolic. But just to pick out a few of those, I think they're all forms of relativism, which is basically the suggestion that there's no such thing as truth, or if there is truth, we can't know it. And I think the ones that I find to be most insidious and most dangerous, the first is sentimentalism. And sentimentalism is when we try to make judgments based simply on our own feelings. That feels bad, or that's unkind, or that's cruel. We can't say something unkind and nasty, and so we make the judgment based on those feelings, or positive feelings. Oh, that's so nice, that he was so kind and he was so generous, and all we're really looking for is a warm welcome and acceptance as we really are. While all these things may be good, they're not the sole criteria for judgment and for truth, and therefore sentimentalism is rife in our society, and so many people make their decisions according to really how they feel about things, what their emotions are. And this is not surprising. We all rely on our hearts. Our hearts and our emotions guide us and drive us so often. But the person who is thinking carefully will recognize the pressure of the heart, as it were, and counter it with the intellect of the head, so that the two are able to balance each other. The second one, which I think is most dangerous in our society, is utilitarianism. And utilitarianism is basically the idea that whatever works is good. We Americans are a practical people. We like things to run on time. We like efficiency. We're a nation of engineers and inventors. And we pride ourselves in our technology and in things that work. We like things to be useful. And, gee, we wouldn't be talking if we didn't have this wonderful technology to be able to do all the stuff that we're doing. And the new media is – so I'm not against any of that. However, when we apply that principle of what works is good, or what's efficient is good, or what is practical is the only good, then we get into deep trouble, because there are a lot of things we stand for which aren't in the first instance necessarily effective or efficient or cost effective. And so when we apply these judgments, especially to moral and theological questions, we get into very deep trouble. And it doesn't take much to think this through. One of the reasons the crime of abortion is so rife in our society is because so many people have made utilitarian choices. They've said, for instance, this is a crisis pregnancy. The girl can't afford to have a baby. The child's going to have a difficult life in poverty. There's going to be a lot of stress here. The easiest thing, the most effective thing, is simply to terminate that pregnancy, to kill the unborn child. The same thing is going to be happening at the end of life issues, is already happening at the end of life issues. Here's grandma. She's been lying in bed with dementia for the last 2 years. She doesn't seem to have any so-called quality of life. And Furthermore, guess what? She's run out of money. And the best thing is to just give her an injection, give her a few pills, and let her slip away quietly. You can see the argument. And so these utilitarian arguments are basically rooted in the idea that there is no other world than this one, that there is no heaven, there's no hell, there's no afterlife, there's no final judgment. And so basically, although utilitarianism doesn't explicitly say that it's atheistic, it is in effect atheistic. It's a fruit of atheism, and that's the third ism, of course, which is rife, and not just explicit atheism, which is like the new atheists who are speaking up and writing books about it. Most of those atheists, it seems to me, are not primarily atheists. They're primarily anti-religionists. Yes, they say there's no God, but most of their invective and most of their anger, most of their rage is direct towards the church and towards religion. They're really anti-religionists. And along with that, of course, they claim to be atheists as well. They're not the one. They concern me. The ones that concern me the most, atheists that concern me the most in our society, are the what I call default atheists, the people who go through their life eating, sleeping, breeding, shopping, playing and watching TV and never really actually considering life at all. I think it was probably Plato who said it was the unexamined life, the life in which people just go through and live their life like, well, like beasts, I suppose, and never ever give God or the afterlife or the spiritual life any thought at all. Now, those seems to me are the true atheists.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your newest book, which is called Catholicism Pure and Simple. It's kind of a walkthrough of all the basic tenets of Catholicism. You take people from the very beginning, from the existence of God, all the way to heaven, hell, and the final things. One thing I really like about the book is that it's very Lewisian, and by that I mean it reminds me a lot of the same style, tone, carefulness of C.S. Lewis. Both of you write with a very simple, direct style, maintaining warmth and humor and wit, and all of that makes the message much more attractive. Now, you studied at Lewis's alma mater, Oxford, and as an Anglican, and even as an evangelical, read him very vigorously. What has C.S. Lewis taught you the most, maybe particularly regarding evangelism and spreading the faith?
Well, I have to clarify one thing here. You know, it makes it sound like I was actually sitting in the Bird and Baby pub with him and Tolkien and taking some notes from him. Quite that old. But certainly I learned an awful lot from him in reading his essays, his famous books, and his not-so-famous works as well. He has one particular essay about in which he is giving instruction actually to Anglican seminarians, and he's sharing with them how to actually communicate the gospel. And it's very good because he's trying to get these guys to disengage from all the academic study they've been doing, all the philosophical study they've been doing, all the studies in Greek and Hebrew and all the great theologians and the writers, and saying, look, you need to be able to translate all of that learning, he says, in a way that your cleaner can actually understand. He's talking to upper class Englishmen who had cleaners, but the same thing applies. You need to be able to explain this to the guy who comes around to fix your washing machine. You got to be able to explain this to the postman or the person who works at the drive-in restaurant if you get a chance. So that's the real challenge. And in a way, I hope no academics are going to be offended, but any old dummy could write a PhD thesis, but it takes someone who's really working hard to translate those concepts into language which everybody can understand in a way, but also without being patronizing or condescending or talking down to people. And Lewis gives some pointers there, and some of the practical pointers are, first of all, get tuned in and prick up your ears towards anything which is theological jargon, ecclesiastical jargon, liturgical jargon, and just weed that stuff out. Don't even try translating it specifically. Just explain it in down-to-earth terms. Also, if you're writing a book, if you're writing for the web or popular readership, don't use footnotes, don't use academic references, you know, don't use highbrow references. I'll never forget one Anglican preacher I heard, and he had not taken C.S. Lewis's advice, and he stood up and he put his nose in the air, and he quoted something about je ne regrette rien, as Jean-Paul Sartre says. And so he immediately put off about 90% of his audience because he was quoting French. Okay, they didn't speak French, so they felt intimidated. Then he was referencing an existentialist philosopher, Jean-Paul Sartre, who, of course, they'd never read and never heard of. And so there's this way of establishing rapport, but without being condescending. And this is what I try to do in Catholicism, pure and simple. I have an exciting project right now. I'm teaching my eighth graders in our parish school for confirmation. And I've given them this book. And I've said, here you go. You're smart kids. Let's see if you can read this. We're going to get away from coloring books and puppy stuff here. And we're going to do some theology. And they love it. I mean, they're getting into it, and they're discussing the concepts. They're remembering the witticisms that are there. And we're having a great time with the book. So if it works, they're my guinea pigs. If it works, I'm then going to write a workbook that goes along with it. And I hope that maybe more confirmation candidates next year will be able to use this resource.
Excellent. And keeping on the same topic of books, let me close with one more question. You have a lot of books in the background of your video. I know you're a bibliophile like me. Outside of the Bible and the Catechism, what would you say are the top three must-read Catholic books?
The top three must-read Catholic books. Well, I have to put The Lord of the Rings, J.R.R. Tolkien's great masterpiece, in there. That's got to be in the top three. I have to mention Chesterton, and I suppose it's got to be The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Number three for a top Catholic book, well, I guess you have to choose your own favorites, and I'm going to go back to the classic of The Rule of St. Benedict, okay, because that stood the test of time, and there's so much holy wisdom there and so much profound wisdom there. But in saying Rule of St. Benedict, I'm including an awful lot of, you have to let me have an awful lot of other Benedictine writers in the same bucket with him. Is that okay?
Sure, I'll allow it. Thanks so much, Father Dwight. You know, it's always great talking with you. I really admire your work, and I know thousands and thousands of other people do as well. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and your upcoming books on the internet?
Well, they're always welcome to visit my blog, Standing on My Head, as you said, which is at Pathios, and there's links there to some of my articles online. Also links to my website where they can browse my books and get in touch. I've also started a weekly newsletter, which is called Faith Works for the Year of Faith. They can sign up for that. It comes free by email. If I'm not doing enough already, I've also started a little radio show, which is starting to go out next month, so they can listen to all those things. Stay in touch. I like when people get in touch with me and talk with me about things, and they can get in touch with all those things mostly through Standing on My Head. That's the main portal.
Excellent. And I know you're working on a couple of new books. You're already quite prolific, but what do you have in the pipeline?
Well, next month, a reissue of my book, Adventures in Orthodoxy, is coming out from Crossroad Publishers with a new title called The Quest for the Creed. I'm also trying to work on for Lent a sequel to The Gargoyle Code called Slub Grip Instructs. And actually, he's going to be talking about a lot of those isms. He's now been demoted to be teaching Pop Culture 101 in the Luciferian University. And so he's got lots of snotty freshmen he's trying to teach, and he doesn't like it very much, but he's doing the best he can.
Excellent. Well, I'm sorry for Slub Grip to see the demotion, but I'm interested to see what he'll advise to his students. Thanks again for talking with me, Father Dwight. And for more interviews, articles, book reviews, and more, check out my own website, which is brandonvaught.com. Thank you.